You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Happy Valentine's Day, I guess. You know, we don't usually do Valentine's Day episodes, so to speak, but this movie had been on our docket for a long time. We decided to do it this season, and of course, it corresponding with the movie's 30th anniversary, which I guess technically was last December, but, you know, it's kind of one of those classics. I didn't see it till college, but it's really quite charming, and it holds up very nicely. We also had a new guest for the first time in a long time, Candace, who is a member of Cineprov with me. If you're listening to this when it comes out, Saturday we have a show that is Frankenstein's Castle of Freaks at the Plaza. It's a late one. It's Saturday at 9 p.m., the 17th. So stay tuned for that, I guess. I hope to see you there. But yeah, I think you'll enjoy this episode. We were all kind of charmed by this movie and we had a great time doing it. Thanks.
My name is Brian Foster.
Everything you know is wrong. Got that?
Now, the reason that I'm calling is because I have begun to suspect you don't have any ladybugs in your freezer.
Hey cuz, Roy here. So about your car.
The darkness was never empty.
There's this presence in my head.
But I'm pretty sure that the book was confiscated by cats.
You're damn right we find a lot of bodies when Foster is around.
And some people call me the Night Blogger.
Welcome to Miami Defend Your Childhood. This week we watched The Princess Bride, The Only Reason Women Get Wet for Carrie Elwes. I am Nick Hoffman, host of Miami Defend Your Childhood and member of Cineprov, because I need to be validated in public. Love me!
You're telling me men in tights don't do that?
But my butt has gotten so big. If there was only a supportive hose for cellulite in my ass.
Why?
I'm not spanking you.
Spanks for men.
I was going to say man spanks, but that's kind of, it's redundant. Kelsey, who are you? And you're on panel.
I'm Kelsey. I don't do podcasts. I don't do Cineprov. I don't know.
Then you are no one, Kelsey.
Disney fangirl Kelsey. And on panel we got...
Hi, I'm Candace, and I am the host of the Rocky Horror Picture Show here in Atlanta for the last 17 years, and a complete narcissist, and I've been at every convention you've ever been at.
This was the last podcast she hadn't been on, so, you know, if you don't listen to her now, you'll never hear her again.
I'm Thomas Herman of the Brothers Herman, host of the Geekly Oddcast, and a frequent contributor here on Myopia, and I'm going to be trying to get her on my podcast next, so.
Yes.
There we go.
Oh, shit, was he pointing at me or Kelsey? No. Fuck.
You.
Oh, yes.
You might get a whole three more listeners.
I know. There we go.
This charmed the hell out of all of us, right?
Oh, yeah.
So we have a freaking contributor here named Kelly, and she's going to punch me. I'm going to see her soon. And if I didn't say I love this movie, I do love this movie. It's very charming, so we're going to make fun of it for the next 20 minutes. But remember,
We love it. Please, please. She's angry and she's Irish and she's a redhead and she will punch the shit out of all of us. So it's lovely. We love you. Thank you. This movie's weird.
It's right? A classic, though.
It is a classic. Rob Reiner made it and he's not on any list in Me Too or anything. So we're okay with liking it so far.
Thank goodness for the next 20 minutes.
Yeah, right. and we have this kind of, God, it's medieval times for lovers. Not that medieval times isn't for lovers, but when you want something that big and fleshy, you hope it's Cary Elwes and not a meat bone.
There's just so many quotable moments and like.
Thanks for resolving my joke. It didn't make any fucking sense.
But like, there's so many things like from this movie that people reference that like, even if you're seeing it for the first time, a lot of things will be like, oh, that makes sense now.
Well, and I mean. God, what's his name? The guy says inconceivable.
Oh, Wallace Shawn.
Wallace Shawn saying inconceivable. He's not only an excellent actor, but inconceivable means exactly what this movie means. The whole joke is that he doesn't understand it. But as adults, that's the only way I get it now. And now that there's a Nick Cage movie called Inconceivable, all I can think is of him running around screaming inconceivable.
Well, that's because Nicolas Cage has no control over the volume of his voice. So he would only be screaming. So that's not inconceivable, actually.
Oh, my Christ.
You know it's true. You know it's true.
Here's the thing about Nick Cage. Nick Cage is what all of us realize we would be if we were actors. Over the top, and whatever they tell us to do, I need a castle, for Christ's sake. He's a cartoon character. Spoilers, because no one listens to this bullshit, but we're going to do National Treasures later this season.
Holy shit. Oh, I am please, on board for please that. Please put me on that.
Yes. Oh, my God. Everyone's here. Like, we're gonna have to do it twice because everyone wants to be on this movie. And the thing is, it's just him with his slick back hair going, my God, the dollar bill's trying to tell me something.
And I think you should hide the Declaration of Independence somewhere in your house as part of the podcast.
It's in my pants.
My God.
Hold up Christ. And shut down.
All right. Jefferson never saw this shit. Well, he did, but...
Madison didn't.
I'm the whitest person he's ever seen it on.
I was going to say you should use that to determine who's going to be on the podcast, but I don't know if I want to be on it that badly if that's where it's
headed. I do.
Candace wins this round. All right. Before we get too far into this, Thomas, can you give us a plot synopsis?
Sure. Movie starts out, and a boy is playing video games on, I'm assuming it's the original Nintendo. Is it Atari?
NES.
Or is it NES, okay. And his mom walks in and says his grandpa's coming over, apparently wants to give him a gift. He doesn't really like his grandpa. Opens it up. It's a really old book. And grandpa starts reading it, and we jump to the actual film. And so he starts reading Farm Boy and Farm Girl, basically, mm-hmm. going through. He's fallen for her, and she slowly realizes that he's in love with her. Problem is, they don't have any money, so they can't get married. So he goes off to find his fortune and is kidnapped and murdered by pirates. Jump forward, because, you know, why not? She's now engaged to be married to the prince and gets kidnapped. Gets kidnapped by three fairly incompetent people. And... Who make up the crux of our comic relief, and followed by a man in black who slowly takes them out one by one. This is actually sounding more like a horror than anything else.
Yeah.
As they move through, we have a great sword fight scene, then a fight with a giant, and then a battle of wits over drinks, which is Nick and I at the bar.
Yeah.
Moving forward, he finally gets the princess, and they realize they're being chased by the prince she is set engaged to. She finds out that he is her love from before. After she boots him down a hill, they go into a fire swamp. They get captured. Moving forward.
I'm going to stop you there. No, just too much to go through all at once.
Exactly.
Spoilers.
There's a boatload in this movie.
So, let's start at the beginning.
Sure.
Cary Elwes.
And Robin Wright.
Fucking most charming human on the planet. Robin Wright turned into the First Lady, and it's just rough. But...
Well, she did take advantage of a mentally ill person first.
Yeah, right.
Or mentally handicapped.
The casting in this is fucking incredible, right?
Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, absolutely. The reason they chose Cary was because he had that very, like, Errol Flynn sort of demeanor and look about him, which is the same reason why Mel Brooks then used him later in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
He's so much better with a sword, though, than Errol Flynn.
Well, I mean, and to your point, he fucking pulls everything off, man.
He really does.
He's the charming prince. He's the handsome sword fighter. Even that really shitty rat tail he sports the whole time, you don't notice. It's not even a surprise rat tail. You're like, oh my. Right? Like
it's a pretty awful rat tail.
It's the worst thing. It's the worst thing about him, but otherwise he'd be too flawless.
That's true. You're like a man with flaws. You know.
He can't be too perfect.
That's right.
But here's the thing about all of it. Everyone looks good. Even the bad guys look good. The thing is that he's just the most handsome. It's very much Ken, like Ken from Barbie's world. Like you know what I mean? And she looks good too, Robin Wright.
She's adorable. She's probably like 20 years old in this movie, and so she's beautiful. I mean, she's right at the end of her Hollywood career, obviously at 20. But
she's
still working it.
So
she managed to edge that out another 30 years, surprisingly.
Right.
I'm trying to desperately pull up IMDb because people look good, and I was going to play the game Guess Rodham Wright's Age, but we're not even there yet. Let's go through the rest. Fezzik.
Andre the Giant.
Correct.
You spoke about during the movie, Candace, about his really thick accent while filming this, so they had to, you know, play his lines for him so that he could mimic that.
That's true. His primary language is French.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was just, you could not understand him when they were trying to do the initial filming. But absolutely just a charming character throughout the entire movie.
I know. He's so sweet and adorable. And it's funny to think that at one time they considered doing Arnold Schwarzenegger. DeVito. Yeah, Schwarzenegger for Fezzik. No, DeVito's the opposite of that. Arnold, the very same year, was doing Predator.
Yes.
And so which you've also done on your podcast, and so they could not use him, and not to mention the fact they couldn't afford him. You know, he was an A-list actor at the time, and this was a side character. But then I'm really glad they didn't get him, because Andre the Giant is just so endearing. And he just seems like he has such a sweet demeanor that I believe he is that character. And
also being like an actual hulking giant as opposed to being like, you know, your chiseled 80s hard body.
Yes.
Makes so much more sense for this role.
Or like a Peter Jackson forced perspective thing, right? Like you could have also just done whoever, you know, you could have done like, if it was Schwarzenegger, it would have been like this weird kind of backwards compatible, like where they zoom out and they zoom in, he looks bigger than he is. And because Schwarzenegger's a bulky guy, but he's, you know, 5'10".
Yeah.
But we should pan back a little. We should talk about the kid being told the story. It's Fred Savage. It's everyone's favorite little
shithead. This came out a year prior to him being cast in The Wonder Years.
Really?
The Wonder Years didn't start till 1988.
Mm. And then he got kicked around by another dad.
Shit.
I like Fred Savage.
I like Fred Savage, too.
Well, and his comedic timing for a kid actor is not only good, but it reminds me actually of a child. It's like the kid from Sixth Sense where you're just like, how the fuck is he pulling this off? I can't even act this well as a kid when I'm a kid.
Man, that makes me think of Haley Joel Osment right now. You know, he should have been Anakin, by the way. I'm just throwing that shit out there. I don't think that would have helped that much.
Can you imagine him in the re-edited version of Return of the Jedi, just like a fat Anakin now? Because he's like a fat kid. He's just like, hey guys, God, Jesus, Luke, can you get this shit together and get me a sandwich? One of them sandwiches.
You know, where the mutton's real lean and the good MLT.
Good MLT.
That's right, Billy Crystal is in this movie, but much later.
Peter Falk is in this, too.
That's right. Yeah, Peter Falk as the grandfather, which he doesn't even have a name. He's just the grandfather is his title, is so funny and delightful, and even though it's such a small part. But I don't know if it was the 7 Kentucky Sunrises or the bag of sour gummy bears, but it really touched me at the end, and I was crying.
I truly enjoy the fact that this movie doesn't need for the story perspective, you have a complete movie from the entire perspective, from farm boy to getting the girl at the end. You have a complete circle of a movie, 3-act structure, it's perfect. Yet, at the same time, adding in the child and the grandfather, the reading of the story to break it up for comedic element and all of that just raises this to another level that makes it truly enjoyable.
Totally.
Absolutely. And I think for me, it's not just because it fills in story gaps. It's because it reminds you that it's stupid as hell. Right? You know, because the rest of it is not even pretending to be a real movie. It's like, because Cary Elwes is like, the rats of unusual size? I think they're a myth. Right as one attacks them. It's a Three Stooges bit. It's not even like a Marx Brothers well-written bit. Like, you know, because Carl's out there and it's funny. It's stupid. It's over the top. It's just throwaway jokes. And so for a kid to be like, is this a kissy part? And the granddad's like, is it a kissy part? I mean,
you're going to like that when you're older.
I like how just then you sounded like the monarch's girlfriend.
Doctor girlfriend?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I've been smoking for a bit, and I'm trying to fill out this dress, and I'm sorry, my boobs aren't what you want them to be.
Exactly.
Christ. But, I mean, the other side of it is not just that he's a kid, it's that Peter Falk comes in like the terrifying old person you don't understand. He has the hat on, he's like, I have a book for you. And he's like, I'd rather play Nintendo.
I have a fucking book for you, kid.
And you're just like, all right, he's going to read it to us.
And he pulls out a massive tome like that he's going to read in a day. This would be the equivalent of today, you know, grandfather showing up to read their child Harry Potter, like, in a sitting. And just go. And
you say that like it's a bad thing.
No, I don't say it's like a bad thing. I just say it's like how, in a sitting, like, to read out a lot, like, aloud. I think, like, what if you look at any of the audiobooks, it's a 14-hour, you know, sit-through. No child's going to.
It's intense.
Well, and he comes in like the goddamn old priest from The Exorcist. He's like, I have something that will cure your illness. And you're just like, Christ, he's going to kill this kid.
Does Fred Savage's head spin around? Because if so, that would make the movie even more.
Better epic. Movie. Better movie.
Definitely.
The power of rom-com compels you.
Oh, my God. He just starts barfing halfway through. Oh, control save, nailed it. Like, this is like an alt version.
All right, so we have to behave ourselves. We have to get back on track.
All right,
so we talked about Andre the Giant as one of the three trio.
All right, so we have Wesley who's scooping shit. He disappears. He becomes later. And we have this trio between Vizzini, who's the giant.
No.
Fezzik is the giant, because that's what you asked about. Vizzini is the mind, and Inigo Montoya is the sword.
Correct.
Of the three of them, Inigo Montoya is the interesting one to me. He's Mandy Patinkin. He's a sword fighter with a mullet. And
he's got a backstory. He's the only one that has a backstory, really.
The six-figured man killed six-fingered, not six-figured. He's
we can make $1 million man faster.
He killed his dad after refusing to pay him for a fancy sword.
Yes.
And so we have a swordsman against a swordsman, as we'll find out. I like Mandy Patinkin's character because not only is he a developed character, but because Mandy Patinkin is charming. And it starts out as kind of a Hodor one guy with a one line and develops into this fucking awesome. We're talking about this movie because everyone's fucking seen this, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally. I don't think there's anyone who
this
hasn't
seen it.
This is
a cult classic, especially from a movie that bombed so badly at the box office.
Yeah, I think it took, it was 16 million is what their budget. And then it made 30 million in box office. But what it killed was at home, you know, like the VHS kind of release. And that's where it finally made its money. In fact, little known fact, that same year, the movie that actually killed the box office was Three Men and a Baby.
Oh!
You want to talk about a piece of shit you should review? There you go.
Oh, Ted Danson would have been funny in this movie. As the bad guy?
No.
Right? As the prince?
I don't want Ted Danson to be the bad guy.
Oh, but
Sam
as the
Malone.
Prince? As the
in
prince?
The Good Place. It's amazing.
Yeah.
He's so good in The Good Place. You might have seen this, so you might have to sit out, but do you know how much it made domestically? You want to take a stab? 1987 money?
I'll take a stab.
Yeah, go.
So I think their budget was 16 mil, so I'll say, I think they made just a little over, so maybe 25 mil?
Don't
look.
I'm not, I can't see.
She's blind by these numbers.
I am, though.
So, so worldwide budget, worldwide.
Wait, is it just 30? U.S.
Domestic,
or world, domestic?
Well, yeah, no.
Okay, so maybe 21.
Is this like Price is Right? Is it like the lowest amount without going over?
I don't
know. The closest?
We can do that. We can do okay. lowest without going over. All right.
I'm going to say it just made back. It just slightly.
If you say a dollar, I'm going to smack you in the face.
I was going to say 17.
And what'd you guess?
25.
Nailed it. It's 30.8.
Wow.
And it was nominated for one Academy Award.
For what?
For
you want to guess?
Soundtrack.
It should be for the soundtrack.
Mark Knopfler nailed it.
Best original song.
Mark Knopfler, yeah. Dire Straits. Come on, man.
Damn. Storybook story.
Jesus Christ.
They sing it at the end, like during the ending.
They do.
Credit, like,
they do. You get, and you, it's a really, like, that deep song. Like, you know, when you really what, get into no, singing, like, Pokemon.
What, no, honestly, you know what that's, talking what, about? That's what Rod Stewart, Brian Adams were going for at the end of Three Musketeers. Like, the All for One, All for Love. That horror.
Oh, see, I was thinking of more like the Bryan Adams, like the Kevin Costner fucking Robin Hood one.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Shit, I was like in sixth grade. That shit was deep back then to me.
It was the seventh highest grossing PG movie of the year.
Wow.
And number one was Three Men and a Baby. And you want to guess, okay, because we're talking about this, it got 30 million, as we mentioned, 30.8. Mm-hmm. 3 Men and a Baby won $167.8 million.
Holy shit.
Lord help us all.
That's a lot of people. It's all fucking
like, Space Cabal's got $38 million.
And that movie is amazing. Thank you very much.
Okay, first of all, it's bullshit, but it's funny. Living Daylights and Roxanne and Moonstruck, Academy Award winning for Nick Cage.
Okay,
won an Academy
listen,
Award.
I'm not saying that we may have undercovered something, but everything goes back to Nick Cage, you guys.
And more in a Candace and I's wheelhouse. Over the Top, the Sylvester Stallone arm wrestling movie was number 18.
Oh, motherfucker.
And Ernest Goes to Camp, which is a Stay Tuned, is number 13. This and Harry and the Hendersons was one below this.
Oh, shit. Harry and the Hendersons was the shit when I was a kid.
And that's for, a and Stay Ernest, Tuned. And for Ernest, know what I mean, Vern? Know what I mean?
Hey, Vern, I'm going to stick my dick in this electrical socket.
Listen, so the one where he goes to camp is actually really sweet and adorable.
That's a tearjerker.
It is
man.
A tearjerker. It's sad because it's always like inner city kids, and they go to camp, and Ernest teaches them about friendship and shit.
They get fed the worst food imaginable.
They're gonna be bulldozed. They're gonna bulldoze over the camp, but he stops it, you guys.
It was either that or a bikini car wash. That's how you save a camp.
You gotta have a montage of saving.
Ernest Goes to Jail was a trip, though.
Nowadays, we just have montages of saving Matt Damon. It's really sad.
And my favorite was the articles, how much money has been spent by the U.S. government to save Matt Damon.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of money.
The problem is, if you consider it by scale, really it's The Martian that takes it just over the top.
Oh my God.
Is it remember the movie we started with?
I do.
Yes,
I do. And I was trying to get us through the whole thing, and you stopped me at the Fire Swamp.
Okay, so at Fire Swamp, so Dread Pirate Roberts is desperately following the ship of the three.
Yes.
He catches up to them, and then we have a series of feats of strength.
A sword fight, a feat of strength, and then a battle of wits.
And right. we found out while watching the movie that actually our host, Nick, used to fence. Is that correct, Nick?
I am a fencer. I fence Pepe and Foil. Yes. I'm sitting on the fence about fencing. I coached it for 6 years. I have fought against Olympians and lost miserably. I beat one on a pirate ship in a one-touch competition. But that's it. I do fence. I have my weapons around me, and I will show them, and I won't show my medals, because
wow.
showing your awards to someone is designed to get you laid, and I want to sleep with almost none of you. So,
that means
that.
there's still luck for you, dude.
there's still a chance, Thomas. Wink. But at the end of the day, yes, I was a fencer, and if any schools want to hire me, I will teach fencing to your district, so... but yeah, we have an excellent fencing scene, which, as you mentioned when we were watching it, Thomas, it kind of changed the way they show fencing in movies.
I mean, honestly, if this movie had come out sooner, I imagine that George Lucas would have redone Return of the Jedi's fight scene at the end. Like, everything past this, all, like, sword fighting scenes that went past this movie were, like, the more effort was put into the training and visual shots of them. Because if you think of, like, going back, like, you know, go back to old Hollywood, your Errol Flynn is a great example. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like the, you know, the ta-ta, and then, you know, some quick repartee, and then back to, like, a few, you know, quips back and forth. But nothing major was done. This movie, they sent Cary Elwes and Mandy Patinkin off for months of, you know, fencing training with top world-class fencers. There was a major article about this recently, and I'll...
Top men,
yes. And, I mean, they put in the effort for... And then they just kept reshooting the scene, because when they did it, they ended up filming it. It was too quick, so they had to re-go back and think out the whole choreography.
It's like Wesley Snipes kicking in, like, those Blade movies. You got to slow it down so we can actually see it. Well, I mean, and it's true. It's the way that, as someone who's done all the Bond movies for this podcast, that Die Another Day, or it just looks so fake because they're just like, ha-ha! And stop for a minute to, like, shove someone through plate glass. This feels like fighting. And it's silly, but they're actually doing real work, which is good. Yeah. Like, this movie makes effort, which you wouldn't otherwise do in a comedy. And that's kind of the interesting thing about this.
And I think that really, it takes this movie up a step, because all of those areas where they took effort and they put in more effort than they had to for what the movie was, it shows. And I think that's appreciated and helps it stand for time a little bit better, because otherwise certain things would probably have aged out. Because if this movie hadn't made sword fighting better, another movie would have, or something like that. And then you'd be looking back at this, and it's a silly sword fight anyway. It would be even more absurd if it was a Die Another Day type sword fight.
Well, and especially since, Candace, when we were watching it, you pointed out, this all looks like it's on the set from a bad high school play.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're not here for the sets. You know, the story is so good, though. Like, it's so, again, it's endearing. It's very enchanting. And as a kid, you can appreciate the cool action component of it. But as the adult, you watch it and you're like, oh my God, you're like, this is equally as great. It really did withstand the test of time. I was a little worried watching this, and I was like, oh my God, are they about to fucking ruin everything that I know? But you didn't this time, thank goodness.
Well, and everyone's charming in it. Like, you know, like, the bad guy's bad and the good guys are good, but they're also, like, they're engaging in this way that you just feel like, you're like, oh, Cary Elwes.
It's the Magneto complex. It's that they're bad, but yet you're like, gosh, I still like you so much.
Yeah, everyone, you're engaged when they're talking. Like, even when, as we get through the three tests and they're in the fire swamp, and he's like, you know, it's like, oh, I don't think those rodents of unusual size are real. And they're of course, real. And everything's real in this movie. And when he gets tortured to unconsciousness, Billy Crystal's charming, and Carol Kane is charming, and everyone is fucking charming in this movie. You liar! That's just a witch. She cast a spell on me.
Even the guy who has the key at the gate so that they can get in near the end of the movie, when it's like, I don't have the key. It's like Fezzik, rip his arms and legs off. It's like, oh, you mean this key? And it's just like the lowest character with the least amount of time over everyone else, and it's like, still, just enough and enough effort put into it. It's like, oh, there's another joke. There's another,
yeah,
you know, layer that was added that wasn't necessary to get a good movie, but it's there.
Well, and at the very end, this is such a stupid thing I noticed, but, like, the squibs for no reason when, like, the dog farted. I know. Everyone's looking around like, what the hell's that? All right. But...
God, it's the rodents of unusual size.
The ROUSs are attacking.
God. Jesus Christ.
There's a lightning stench in here.
This is the third time this podcast did.
Can I just say at this moment how excited I am to be here today, and really glad that this is the memories I'm going to hold dear forever of my first time doing a podcast. Thank you.
Just ripping a shit. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you.
I don't even know. My brain reset.
We were talking closer to the end, right?
We were.
We were, but you know what? I'll take you back for a second. Does anyone think that the scene where he's in the torture device and they're going to be taking a year of his life away, did anyone ever find that sexy? Listen, I don't mean to take this to a weird place, but does anyone remember as like maybe like a young teen, like 11, 12, 13 years old, that you thought something about that seemed sexual?
I hope you guys watched us doing Flesh Gordon on Cinebro.
I mean, so basically the discussion here is whether or not Cario was having a year of his life sucked out. Is sexy is I think the question that's going out at the moment.
I mean, listen, I'm sure everybody's been to a Frolicon or something. You know you've seen somebody hooked up to some shit like that before. And I'm just saying, there was something I remember as a kid thinking that that was somehow very sexual. And as an adult when I watched it, we were all sitting down there eating pizza. And I was looking around the room like, does anybody else see this? Am I the only one? Should I bring it up? Should I hide this in my secret box? But no, I decided to just bring it up to everybody.
The internet and Rule 34 are for you, my friend.
Well, I'll tell you what.
So there he was, strapped to a board, and something was strapped to his head. And
nipples.
And turning his crank. And after turning a crank, giving him some head. I mean, getting a year of your life sucked out of your head. I mean, I get it. I mean, I tell you what. You know what? Similarly, I think the scene that I think is the sexy opposite of that is the one where he's in the bed at the end where he's not sure if he can stand, but he's trying to convince Humperdinck he can.
Yes.
It's the same thing in reverse. He's just like, you know, it would be true if I couldn't get up and grab the sword, but... You know, like,
and then there's just like this great swell of like French horns, and you're like, holy shit, this is boss as fuck. He's about to like kill him. And then you're like, oh fuck, he was bluffing the whole time.
Yeah, right. And that's what it is.
It's good.
And I mean, and it's these whole, the dominant masculine thing, right? It's like, who's in control? And he plays the submissive very well, right?
Yeah. He's a bottom. So. Hey, listen, y'all were talking about tops earlier, I'm just saying.
I mean, I just appreciate the way you were averting eye contact and then finishing your drink for just half a second and then recrossed your legs. I get it, Candace.
Oh, my God. So anyways, back to Peter Falk.
No, I was going to say, I'd rather talk about him than the princess.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, it's one of those things of like, I don't dig Buttercup in this movie at all. She's very much just that generic like girl character that's got to be there to make the story, but she doesn't do anything for me. It's all those side characters that are way more interesting. It's Vicini, it's Fezzik, it's Inigo. You know, even Wesley in and of himself is again just kind of the cracker to get my dip, which is all I fucking want out of this.
Well, and more so. Robin Wright's character is just kind of like drug along this movie. She doesn't have much to. She has a few lines, but she's very uninteresting comparatively, and that's a shame.
It's very Keira Knightley.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the difference is at least Keira Knightley occasionally picks up a sword in the Pirates movie.
Yeah.
She doesn't even do that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not her fault.
This is the way this was written. And this is
also
fine.
Her first movie. I mean, so. I think the role was just kind of written for. I mean, they had. I think you said there were other major actresses up for the role.
Which, oh yeah.
If they had been in it, I'm sure there would have been more to it.
Yeah, Carrie Fisher, Meg Ryan, and there was actually I'm trying to think of the one other person that was like really like legitimately in the running, but something happened, and so Robin Wright ended up taking it over instead. But I'm sure it'll come to me. Much like how we had talked earlier that Sean Wallace, of course, was Vizzini in the movie, but originally they had wanted, they considered Danny DeVito, which I think back and think, how would that have made this film differently? And the answer is a fucking lot.
But if it were Danny DeVito and Arnold Schwarzenegger, do you have a remake of Junior or whatever?
Twins. That was the movie they were in. Twins.
Twins. And Junior. I mean, they're together. It's the sequel, I guess.
That's right.
That would have been a fucking hell of a thing. You want to guess how many theaters this opened in?
I don't know.
Nine.
Nine?
That's
what?
It?
That's it?
Moonstruck opened in seven.
Well, I mean, to share.
Wait,
I'm Cher, bitch.
On September 25th, it opened in 9 theaters.
I was great in burlesque.
You were something.
Oh my God! Superman: The Quest for Peace ordered in 1500. All right, we should wrap this up. You want to catch us up with the end of this movie?
Okay, so we come out of the fire swamp, and they meet up with Prince Humperdinck, which is the fiance of the Princess Bride. Since does she actually have a name?
Buttercup.
Buttercup. Thank you. Because they even at the very end of the movie introducing as the Princess Bride, and you're like, that's not her name.
And why do you build me up, Buttercup? I'm done. I'm fucking done.
Thank Go you. Ahead. Thank you. And find up with Humperdinck. Humperdinck makes a deal with Wesley, mm-hmm. which he quickly reneges on as the Count takes him off as to the pit of despair.
BDSM dungeon. Yes, continue.
Precisely. Slow
your roll there, Candy.
And so from there, we move to Buttercup. She's at the castle. She's having bad dreams. She tells Humperdinck, I want Wesley back. He says, all right, I'll send my four fastest chips, and quickly lies. From there, he goes to... was that immediately from that point where he goes to try and kill him? Or was it... No, it was the next one where we move a little bit forward. He says he wants the... This is where we run back into Inigo and Fezzik. From there, when Buttercup asks Humperdinck whether or not the four fastest chips have actually gone out for Wesley, and he slips up, that's where Humperdinck goes and tries to kill Wesley by sucking 50 years out of his life, because, that's what you do. And he starts to scream, which apparently the entire kingdom can hear Wesley screaming.
And everyone ignores it except for our two henchmen.
Our two henchmen, yes. And they go off. They find him. He's dead. They take him. This is where we meet Billy Crystal and Miracle Max.
Oh, well, yeah, he's only mostly dead.
That's where we find out he's only mostly dead.
That's right.
They give him this...
A goddamn borscht belt standard for... He's only mostly dead. I'm not helping.
When he's all dead, the only thing you can do is loot through his clothes and look for loose change.
That's true.
And so they take him to the castle. They give him the pill. He wakes up. They see 50 men in guarding the castle, and apparently it's like, well, we need to help. They figure out how to get into the castle, lighting Fezzik on fire, but not lighting him on fire. They get into the castle. Inside the castle, Inigo runs into the man with six fingers on his right hand and decides to immediately chase after him. That's where they get lost.
I'm helping.
Nicholas has six fingers on his hand. He doesn't really, but he's making it out like that.
Ladies.
The ladies love the six finger.
And moving on. Inigo takes on the count. Fezzik tries to go help him and leaves Wesley behind. When he comes back to find Wesley, Wesley has disappeared. And this is where it's in the middle. All of this is happening in the middle of the marriage between Humperdinck and Buttercup.
Marriage.
What bring that together today? And they force it fast, so they're technically not married. Buttercup runs off to her room to commit suicide. Runs as she's about to plunge a dagger into her chest. Wesley finally decides to speak. And she runs over and starts mounting him.
With the most effective anti-breast cancer campaign we've ever decided.
Yes,
yeah.
No, yes. The line was, there is a shortage of perfect breasts in this world. It'd be a pity to ruin yours. And I honestly think that's what should be used this coming fall. She starts fawning all over him. Prince Humperdinck runs in to try and kill Buttercup. Wesley starts insulting him majorly and then stands up, points his sword at him. Humperdinck proves that truly he is the bottom that we say he all is.
Tense.
Yes. And, drops his sword, jumps into the chair, and gets tied up, as you do. And
this movie, when you describe it this way, takes on a whole nother meaning. Just like y'all to know.
Describe it slower.
As this is happening, Inigo finally takes on the count in the room, looks like he's going to die, but manages to get up. And basically utter the best parting shot as he's going forth with the count. Goes, is like, I'll offer you anything you want. What do you, name what you want. And at Nego, as he plunges the sword into his stomach, goes, "I want my father back, you son of the bitch," which is just the best ending shot
ever. Of any kids' movie ever. Because, oh, yes. Because, like, back then, I mean, you know, you couldn't
this
hear swear words.
This is a whole load of blood, too, yeah, for a kid's, you know.
Yeah, this is like some Quentin Tarantino blood with some, like, fucking, you know, Schindler's List dialogue kind of shit going on. You're like, holy fuck.
Drenched in blood.
I'm 9 years old. God damn.
And so, and then he meets up with Wesley, and then they hear Fezzik out in the courtyard. Fezzik has gotten four white horses because, you know, picturesque. They all jump down into Fezzik's waiting arms, mount the horses, and ride off into the sunset.
In the history of kisses.
And then Peter Falk comes back and it says, oh, it's about to be a kissing scene. Fred Savage goes, oh, well, I guess I can hear it now as puberty is slowly kicking in.
He's become a man.
And so they show the kiss. It's this beautiful kiss. And then the movie ends.
So
well, no, sorry, sorry, no, sorry,
oh
sorry.
Oh my God, you
no,
you're almost
right.
Missed.
No,
the
you're right. No, no, you're sorry. I'm sorry. There's at the very end. So the book ends, and Fred Savage and Peter Falk are in there, and Fred Savage.
Out.
No, and Fred Savage asks his grandfather if tomorrow he could come back and read the book again, and the grandfather turns around and says, "As you wish." And it's kind of this part, this tying in together, because throughout the entire movie, Wesley would always tell Buttercup, "As you wish," which was his way of saying, I love you. And so it was kind of this great, you know, wrapping the movie up in a nice tight bow.
Ladies.
I'm a little emotional.
She's verklempt.
I am. As a kid, it was a fun movie and it was a sweet movie. But as an adult who has since had grandparents pass away, it's like, it takes on another meaning, and it's really endearing. I was legitimately crying in your basement.
I mean, it happens sometimes in my basement.
It does.
I was going to ask you, because we didn't do this up top, but because the Fedder wasn't here, whatever, but how do you guys remember this movie? We'll start with you. When was the first time you saw this?
In college, my sorority used to watch it once a year.
That's when I first saw it, not with your sorority, but I first saw it in college, and all the girls around me loved it, and I was just like, I haven't made out in a while, so I was like cozying up. Girls in my college, I was in a co-ed dorm, it's okay.
It happens at the single-ed dorm too, trust me.
Ladies. But I was going to say, it was a perfectly enjoyable movie. I didn't know what to expect with like a kind of rom-com movie as they pitched it. It's true love. And I'm just like, uh-huh. I mean, I'm trying to think of a shitty movie I'd see. I saw It's Something About Mary. I get love, but...
I fucking hate that movie. Never say that shit at this table ever again.
You have issues, Nick.
Oh, God.
I thought it was funny. I've zipped my balls into my underwear. No,
I'm kidding. I'm not...
From the audience, go fuck up. It was a joke sometimes.
Well, I'll say my viewing was very different than yours because I saw it as a kid. I mean, I was born in 1982, so I remember seeing it like, I don't know, it was probably like 9 or 10 at the time. You know, just old enough to think that that weird torture scene was slightly sexy, which probably says something really deep and disturbing about me.
Well, as an 8-year-old girl, you were like, I need to strap men down. I get it.
Oh, shit, that's pretty much what I've been doing my whole life. Rob Reiner, like, has fucking, like... molded me.
An old Jewish man with a beard is just like
oh my God, that's like the whole story of Hollywood.
I get it now. This movie has a completely different meaning. No, I saw this movie, I think probably about 6 or 7, rented it from Blockbuster with my family, and we just kind of watched through it, and I've been watching this movie probably at least once a year ever since.
Well, it was one of those things when I saw, I mean, the movie that got me back into this is stupid, but was Spinal Tap, because it's another Rob Reiner movie, and I was just like, oh wait, is everything he did this silly? And then I watched this movie and I realized this might be his magnum opus. This and Spinal Tap are brilliant films, but they're different, like, because this is supposed to be that, you know, I was a film minor in college, and so I watched Excalibur, right? Like this fucking over the top pretentious, I was laughing the whole time. Arthur was on the horse in the armor holding the fucking sword. And I was just like, oh, no. Rob Reiner gets it. All of this is 100% horseshit. And if you can find any sort of emotion, you win.
And the second Billy Crystal goes, "Oh, but true love is real. That matters. The rest of this is horseshit." And he's like, "You said to glaive, which is to rob, and that's bullshit." And his wife runs in.
To bluff. To blathe.
Right,
to
blathe, and then when his wife runs in and he's
liar.
Like, "You're a liar. You're lying about love. Love is real." And to me, that's the movie in a nutshell. He's like, "This, what we're doing is horseshit. And yet it's really about love. If you don't get the metaphor, you're the one who's wrong." That's a brilliant twist. He has the Greek chorus, and it's Billy Crystal with an even more ridiculous nose. It's hilarious. Robusto, we're out of time. Christ, we've talked for 45 minutes.
Oh my goodness.
So we should go around the horn. Kelsey, what was your final thoughts on this movie?
I think it's a classic. I quote it all the time.
Brilliant. Candace, what's your final thoughts?
Absolutely agree. Everyone should watch this film and enjoy it, and everybody is going to take something different from it.
I completely agree. I think this could be the metric by which you judge Friends by. Like, if they don't like this movie, there must be something wrong with them. Otherwise, I think everyone should see this movie. I agree. I quote it all the time, frequently, probably to an extreme, but I enjoy it, and this movie's fantastic.
Perfect. My thoughts on this are simple. Yes, do the Thomas and Candace and Kelsey thing. Watch it with friends. Enjoy it. Love it. It's a good movie. And then if you're having one of those bad days, you pour yourself a tall glass of red wine and then you have an ugly cry and watch this movie, because it's not only a good movie, it actually is an enjoyable, like, kind of deep relationship-y movie. And for Kelly, who's listening to this because she wasn't on this panel and is probably cursing at me under her breath, don't hit me because you're terrifying. I've seen you take off your leg and hit someone during football, with her leg, her fake leg. Here's the thing.
That's a Surf Ninjas joke right there.
No, she did it to Zeus. She did it to Zach Krause. I saw him. Here's the thing. It's a wonderful movie. We love this movie. We made fun of this movie. It's still better than any joke I've made because Rob Reiner's still alive, and I will kill him and eat his heart so I can his fatty, delicious heart to get his magical joke powers. But I will say, as we run low on time, we have to talk about our next movie. As The Princess Bride is coming out on Valentine's Day, because we love all of you, we have another movie coming out after this. Unfortunately, that movie is not about love. It's about eating people. So choose Arnold Schwarzenegger's first sci-fi movie. And there's two governors in this movie. You can find a Schwarzenegger movie with two governors in it. You have won. So tune in next week and every future week as we put your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
There's a fair chance you don't like the news, and I get that. I'm Buzz Burbank, and I do a different kind of newscast I think you will like. I tell stories, true stories, because when you view it the right way, there's nothing more amazing than real life. I cover most of the stuff the big media outlets cover, but often with a different approach, richer in detail, and with a perspective that ties it all together so we have some idea of what it all means. I deliver stories that'll make you laugh, make you cry, and make you angry, because that is the nature of life, and because you cannot be a better citizen unless you understand and feel the news. I also don't cover some of the useless stories you'll find elsewhere, and do cover real stories the rest of the media somehow managed to avoid. With my nearly 40 years' experience in broadcast journalism and a love of writing, this is a news program that's custom made for you. Buzz Burbank News and Comment is now a weekly show, new each Thursday, and available free on iTunes, SoundCloud, and several other platforms, and at buzzburbank.com. In addition to the other shows you enjoy here on the ESO Broadcast Network, thank you for adding me to your playlist as well.
Myopia Defender Childhood is a member of the ESO Network and produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman. It is edited by Nick Hoffman and Candace Burns. The theme song is Caroline by the Serenaders, and their music is available on Amazon. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. And tune in next week when we put another little piece of your past on trial. Thanks!
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.